Welcome to Shade with me, Lou Mensah. Shade speaks with artists and activists who challenge these stereotypes on race at a time when identity politics is at the forefront of our cultural landscapes. This week I speak with Dr. Lauren Michelle Jackson, who teaches in the departments of English and African American Studies at Northwestern University. Her first book, White Negroes, was published this month. White Negroes exposes the new generation of whiteness, which thrives at the expense and borrowed ingenuity of black culture, and explores how this intensifies racial inequality. Lauren's book reveals why cultural appropriation, something that's become embedded in our daily lives, deserves serious attention. It's a blueprint for taking wealth and power, and ultimately exacerbates the economic, political, and social inequity that persists in America. White Negroes summons a reinterrogation of Norman Mailer's infamous 1957 essay of the same title. So I was delighted to get some new equipment for the recording of this episode, and of course something went wrong, so we had to start the interview all over again, and Lauren was so patient and so gracious. So listen, I just hope you enjoy it, and let's just cross our fingers that everything with the sound goes well.
That's never happened before.
Well, I think it happens to like every journalist and every podcaster. So I guess this is your turn. Yeah, we could take it from the top.
So Lauren, what would you say for the listeners who are not familiar with the issues of appropriation? Is the difference between appreciation and appropriation? We've become accustomed to responding to what we see, and yet at the same time, perhaps unaccustomed to seeing the real insidious ways in which it's truly affected our daily lives. Could you just talk a little bit about the differences for us?
So I think there is what I would call a profound misunderstanding about appropriation, in the sense that I think now when people use the term appropriation, there is already like this sort of built-in hostility. And so we are used to seeing that word and hearing it applied to, as you say, the sort of insidious ways that culture can travel and circulate. And so we put it on this scale where appreciation is on one end and an appropriation is on the other, where appreciation is good and appropriation is bad, when really appreciation is in itself a form of appropriation. And so when I describe appropriation as a movement, what I'm saying is that the actual act of appropriation, of taking one thing and making it appropriate to another circumstance, is not, it doesn't have like built-in, you know, that hostility actually isn't inherently there. And so when we think about an example I use in the book is hip hop culture and rap music, which is a genre and a movement, a culture that could not have existed without intergenerational appropriation, without cross-cultural appropriation, without interracial appropriation. But we don't tend to think about it like that. When we talk about appropriation in terms of rap music, we're usually thinking of the white rapper who is performing this traditionally thought of as black genre. And so I think the real takeaway is that there isn't, it's not either appropriation or appreciation. Appreciation is just a kind of kinder, I guess we could say kinder word for someone who appropriates in a way that we find favorable. But ultimately, a lot of appropriation is, you know, is done unknowingly, it's done unthinkingly. We appropriate otherwise, words and fashion and things that sort of come into our knowledge and come into our style that we a lot of times don't think about where they come from. And so that's no less appropriation than the person who maybe is a little bit more thoughtful, as in deliberate, about their appropriation of something else. But really, I think, you know, appreciation and appropriation are just two different words to really describe what is ultimately the same gesture.
Mm-hmm. And there's a loose connection between the title with Norman Mailer's essay.
I came across Mailer's essay, The White Negro, sometime in grad school, I believe, I can't recall exactly. And I think one of the things that first impressed me was that it's an infinitely stranger essay, I think, than the way the title gets invoked suggests. So the actual white Negro figure is only referred to once by that actual name. So you go into the essay expecting it to be some sort of, similar to a contemporary essay about appropriation. And actually, it's really about trying to diagnose certain crises going on with a certain segment of white youth and trying to think about why it is that the post-war hipster needs to revel in blackness. And it's an interesting essay. It wasn't, in some ways, when I was writing the proposal and submitting the proposal, the title initially began as just really sort of a shallow riff on that actual essay. But if I was going to invoke Mailer, I did want to engage with that essay in some way in the actual book. And so there is a chapter that I call The Hipster, where I do think about what he's saying in that essay in a contemporary context and connect it to the way that a lot of hip lingo circulates today. Mm-hmm. And as for the topic of appropriation, as it came to structure the book, it was never something that I thought I would go into as my beat or anything like that. It was more a matter of me doing a lot of writing for the internet and looking back and realizing that there was this trend in a curiosity for the way interracial aesthetics circulate and merge and are impressed upon each other, particularly in an online space, particularly in an age of digital culture, where digital culture is mass culture, is, you know, all culture is American culture. And that's really what I approach the book with a curiosity about. So not to chastise anyone really, but really to approach it in the vein of a critic and think about how things happen and why things happen that you often don't get a whole lot of time to have curiosity about as a freelance writer.
You talked about a French photographer, Jean-Paul Gould, who's known for his fetishization of black women's bodies. He's even gone so far as to say that blacks are the premise of my work. Well, you reference Kim's identity, in particular, her portrait that she had taken by Jean-Paul Gould. And you said that it's Kim who at the moment stands as a one-woman metaphor for America's twisted relationship with race. And I thought that image was particularly interesting with reference to that statement, because the image encapsulates so much of what you're talking about in your book. Could we just break it down a bit and look at what that image is saying within the context of appropriation?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot going on here. Now, just to start in the why view, I go back and forth on how interesting I think Kim Kardashian actually is. I had an event and someone asked me a question about Kim Kardashian and Donald Trump, like what is the link between them? And I was being a little bit facetious and saying, thinking about their meeting of the minds that they had last year, I believe. But I really do think they both tell a story of America in a really condensed way. The two of them, these two reality TV stars, you know, define so much of the past decade and a half, you could say. But I think Kim is particularly interesting because I think her racial identity or assignment is so circumstantial in ways that we maybe used to talk about a little bit more but don't talk about as much now in public, because she's such a staple, I guess, in American royalty, right? So much has happened since this paper cover, but so rewinding back to It's November 2014. Paper Magazine, she's their cover girl with their this sort of trending series that they do. They called Break the Internet, you know, Kim Kardashian. And so she's on the cover here in this really form-fitting, like, black sequin dress, holding a popped bottle of champagne, and it's sort of artfully foaming into this cup that's actually seated behind her because she's photographed in profile, and it's seated on, you know, her butt in a way that obviously, like, draws attention to that area even more so than would otherwise be drawn there. And what was interesting is that the pose and the photograph is like an almost exact replica for another photograph this photographer published in the 70s, which is called Carolina Beaumont, New York. In that case, it was a black woman, and she was nude, and she was photographed in a way that I think he has a preoccupation with photographing black skin in a way that makes it look like almost like artificial or painted on. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because, so here we have like a reappropriation of that photograph featuring Kim Kardashian, someone with interestingly ethnicized figures who has gradually over the years sort of effaced a lot of those features on her face while making certain alterations to her body and changes in fashion that sort of move her in the other direction. So it's like her face has gotten more anglicized and her body has gotten thick with two C's in all the right places in a way that's very suggestive of black aesthetics. And so like all that is being signified here in this photograph where she is standing in for the black woman that Goad would otherwise be photographing, but it is in this way that is much more whimsical because she's tan and she's against this brown background. And there's just like, I don't want to ramble, but there's just like a lot of, it's just like there's a lot of like stuff going on here that we could read very closely that is also in some ways an allegory for just Kim, period. And I didn't get to write about a lot of this, some of this in the book because it happened after I submitted the manuscript, but it's also really interesting to think about the Kardashian Jenner family and their proximity to blackness while Kanye is having this like really strange moment in his career, and while Kim is off here like doing work on behalf of quote unquote prison reform and is saying she's going to, you know, take the bar and get her law degree and that this is her passion now. And it's just like this very, very strange trajectory for both of them that it's happening contemporaneously. And I think from, you know, a racial reading or a racial perspective, there's just like, you know, I wrote about it in part of a chapter. I didn't even linger on the Kardashians that long, but like you could go on for days thinking about it. And so that was part of my interest there. But, you know, I tried not to linger too long on the Kardashians, if only because I think there's so much that's been said there already. And, and so I don't know how much is there left to say.
I was really interested in the fashion chapter. And one of the case studies that you used was the Marc Jacobs Spring Summer 2017 show, where his models wore fake dreadlocks, and he brought in a hairstylist particularly to make up these wigs to great expense. And what was interesting to me was when you said that the stylist was asked if Rastafarian culture was an inspiration for the looks, and the response was no. And there was a lot of responses to that show and the looks in that show. But a year later, Jacobs did respond to the calls of appropriation by saying, what I learned from the whole thing was that maybe I don't have the language for this, or maybe I've been insensitive because I operate so inside my little bubble of fashion. So it seems like perhaps he was taking on board. And again, this is not to focus perhaps on him as a person, but it's just maybe indicative of some of the exchanges that we have. But after him sort of gently acknowledging the cause of appropriation, a year later, his models wore turbans and head wraps down the runway. And I'm just thinking, where does this leave us with the conversations from the standpoint of getting the messages across? You know, it's like my concern, which I'm sure is yours and so many people's as well, is the message getting across? Or actually, is there a message coming from the other way, you know, from them, like their responses to these calls? And if so, I'm thinking, you know, what is it?
So I actually think Jacobs was saying something really precise and really smart, even if he maybe didn't know, know what he was saying that was so smart, when he says, you know, maybe I don't have a language for this because I operate inside my little bubble of fashion. And I think, like, that's really true. We forget that I think a lot of these people really do operate or think they're operating within these really, really insular cultures and insular, areas of fashion or what have you. And he's saying, you know, being in this culture, in this little bubble of fashion, has not afforded me the language to describe what's going on in culture, because fashion, particularly designer fashion, has a vested interest in not examining race or not thinking about race in a conscious way. And so when he says that, he's really saying something larger about fashion. He's also saying larger about the circles he wades through and thinks about. And that essentially, you know, if you live in fashion, you have the luxury of not thinking about certain kinds of things. And so that may seem simple or self-evident, but it's very true. And so if you're someone who doesn't think about these things very often, then yeah, you're going to send, you know, models down the runway in, you know, white models in turbans the year or a couple years following, sending models down in fake dreadlocks or Bantu knots or something like that. You're going to keep making this same gaffe over and over again until you start reading a book or something, or you leave this tradition that you are so enmeshed in that lets you be so ignorant for so long.
And that keeps us sort of at an impasse, because it's almost, you know, well, what do we have to say to that? I'm interested in the wider, taking a step back and looking at the wider discussions in your book. And there seems to be a strong theoretical backdrop to your discussions, both in the way that each case study is structured and in your overall interest in the economic conditions of the appropriators and the appropriated, respectively. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how you've developed your style and skill for analysis. And maybe who are some of the salient figures or inspirations that you've come across through the journey of your intellectual development? It's just so interesting to me because it's just very rare that you have a book that's so accessible in terms of its content, but is so rich in terms of explaining just deep systemic structures as well for an audience. And I just thought it was just a beautiful juxtaposition in your book, and so I'm just interested about your influences.
Oh, thank you. First of all, yeah, so the thing about doing a PhD in literature is that you get to read a lot, you read all the time, and you get to read a lot of really great, brilliant thinkers who are also really great, amazing writers. And I've had the, you know, privilege of being trained by brilliant thinkers and brilliant writers. Yeah, as for people whose writing I admire, whose brands I admire, I mean, I have to put in the plug for Homi Bhabha, like a amazing cultural theorist, whose the location of culture was like incredibly formative, and it remains incredibly formative to the ways that I think about race and culture and coloniality and ambivalence. Eric Lott, of course, gets a mention. Mm-hmm. I think his Love and Theft gets I think it gets invoked sometimes for the wrong reasons, because people don't actually think about the ambivalence that's actually at the heart of the historical record that he's tracking in that book. But of course, you know, Love and Theft is iconic. And also, he has a more recent book, Black Mirror, that is also really, really good and really fascinating as well. People like Hilton Alls, people like Lauren Berlant, C.N. Nye, Judea Hartman, Christina Sharp. I'm like looking around my
I'm writing like, notes right here.
Closest to me. But you know, I won't like curl off. But you know, there's a lot of, you know, Doreen St. Felix, who's at the New Yorker, Gia Tolentino. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, so many people. I just like read, you know, read really good writers, because the, you know, the best writers are also like the deepest thinkers too. And so all these people are always in my head when I'm compiling an archive and when I'm thinking about how to approach a certain subject. And so they've all been super formative in some way to how I approach writing and thinking.
Thank you so much for sharing. When I do the edit, I'm making notes. I will look into all of those. So thank you so much. And if my listeners want to follow your work, you get a lot of work published separate to this book. You publish a lot of articles online. Where can they find some of your work, and perhaps how can they follow your work on social media?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Prose Before Bros, P-R-O-S-E, the letter B, the number 4. B-R-O-S, Prose Before Bros. And yeah, all my other, the link to my website, all my other socials are like through there. And yeah, I mean, when I write stuff out, I tend to tweet it out obnoxiously. So yeah, that's probably what keep up with me.
Wicked. Awesome. Thank you so much. That was an absolute joy.